Welcome to the NOLA Drink Show. Join us as we explore the world of drink, food, and culture in New Orleans and beyond. Here's your host, Brian Diaz.
All right, everybody, welcome to the show. Brian Diaz here with you, friends. Thanks for listening in this week to the NOLA Drink Show. We do appreciate it. As always, hope everyone had a great weekend. Got a good show coming up for you here today. We are going to be chatting with two cocktail luminaries, Julie Reiner and Dale DeGroff. Dale is known as a King Cocktail author. Julie, a very famous bartender, bar owner, and they all kind of connected in New York. And we're all really involved in the cocktail renaissance, if you will. We throw that term around from late 90s, maybe 2000. And a lot of these folks, Julie and Dale included, were really the touchstone people for a lot of what we're seeing in the cocktail world today. So it's a pleasure to chat with them. We do this by phone. And part of what we're talking about is the theme of women in spirits and the cocktail world. And kind of the springboard for this is we're talking about a cocktail competition that went on during Tales of the Cocktail, sponsored by Marie Brizard, who makes all kinds of fine liqueurs and syrups and all kinds of interesting stuff. It's an interesting company. They actually date back to the 18th century and founded in part by Marie Brizard herself in Bordeaux, France. And they have a huge line of products these days. And we're going to sample three of them and sort of chat about it as we talk about other things, the cocktail competition, Dale's background, Julie's background, how they met, talking about women and spirits, so on and so forth. But going back to about 1763, I believe is when it was, they created an anisette, and that was really the flagship spirit or liqueur, I should say, that they had over the years, and and became very, very popular over time. And then now, as I said today, their product line is pretty extensive, some pretty interesting stuff. And the Marie Brizard cocktail competition that took place at Tales was a really cool cocktail competition. We do get into it quite a bit, but it was called Toast to Her Story, you know, as opposed to history. Her story. And so H-E-R-S-T-O-R-Y. And the idea was the contestants had to submit a cocktail recipe, obviously using at least one Marie Brizard product. But they also had to name the cocktail after an inspirational woman. Now, that could have been somebody who was an inspirational woman in their life, a relative or something along those lines, or it could have been an historical figure, a contemporary artist, any number of things like that. And they boiled it down to a handful of finalists, and then they had the competition there at Tales of the Cocktail this year in July and selected a winner, and the winner was Jenna Lane Ellenwood. And we talk about the background of her drink. It's named after her friend's grandmother. It's called the Songbird of Manzanar, and her friend's grandmother was a prisoner at a concentration camp, the Manzanar concentration camp to be specific, during World War II, and she apparently had a great voice, and so she was nicknamed the Songbird of Manzanar. We get into that a little bit during the interview, but I wanted to give Jenna Lane Ellenwood there, the winner, I wanted to give her a little bit of run here on the show because of her drink, and we didn't really talk about specifically, we touched on that a little bit too, but I wanted to give you the specs on the drink if you were interested in making it at home. She starts with three dashes of ginger bitters, and she uses the Hella Bitters brand. There are a few out there that you can find, but three dashes of ginger bitters, three drops of ume plum vinegar. Ume plum, and basically it's a pickled plum vinegar, and it's a Japanese product. She uses the Eden Soy brand. You can find, I think, some variations on that. You can certainly find it at Asian markets and at Amazon, or on Amazon. Just look for ume plum vinegar, U-M-E. Interesting stuff there. And then she uses 1 ounce of Marie Brizard yuzu. And yuzu is a Japanese liqueur, citrus liqueur. It's a fruit. And actually, that's one of the things Marie Brizard started making one a few years ago. And that's one of the things you actually taste on the show. And then she uses a 1.5 ounce of Amos gin and a 1/2 ounce of Quintanier Blanc Vermouth Roya. And if you're not familiar with the Quintanier Vermouth, very, very nice product, very floral, got a lot of character to them. They're one of my favorite vermouths out there, and you can find those pretty easily these days in most market spaces. So once again, it's three dashes of ginger bitters, three drops of ume plum vinegar, 1 ounce of Marie Brizard yuzu liqueur, 1.5 ounce of Amos gin, and a 1/2 ounce of Quintanier Blanc Vermouth Roya. Take all those ingredients, put them in a mixing glass, stirred. This is a stirred drink, friends, and then strain it into a chilled Nick and Nora glass. And then you can garnish it with a shisho leaf, which I believe is also known as like beef leaf, I think is what it's called. And the shisho leaf is also used in the ume plum vinegar as a kind of an additive to it. I think it changes the flavor there a little bit. Not 100% sure on that one, but that's how she garnishes it. So very nice drink. Again, the Songbird of Manzanar. Congratulations to Jenna Lane Ellenwood for her win. And yeah, as I said, we'll get into that a little bit more about the competition and stuff. We chat with Julie and Dale in just a moment. Friends, if you're listening here to the show on the radio, I always like to encourage you to go get the podcast. Go to NOLADrinks.com, our website, and there you will find links to the podcast on your favorite podcast platform, Stitcher, Spotify, iTunes, Android, Google Play, TuneIn Radio. I think that probably pretty much covers it. Or you can just get it straight from our website. You'll see the latest four episodes right at the top and then the next 10 down a little bit. If you click on episodes in the link, you can go back and find all of our episodes going back about 2.5 years now or so, maybe longer, 3 years of the NOLA Drink Show. And I encourage you to get it that way. Why? Because, well, we do an extended chat as always when we do the podcast. It's called Another Shot with NOLA Drinks. And this episode this week is no exception to that. Dale and Julie stick around and we kind of get a little more specific about women in the cocktail industry and the spirits industry, and talk about a little bit about the changing landscape that we see these days as both longtime veterans of the industry. They have a very interesting perspective. Of course, Julie, being a woman, also has a very interesting perspective on all of this. And so we chat about that in the podcast only portion, friends. So do go check that out. Hey, and if you're listening on a podcast network, I always appreciate a review, preferably a good review, but a review. So give us a review there on Stitcher and Spotify and all that stuff. If you have the time, I would appreciate it. Friends, we're going to take a little break here on the show. Then we're going to bounce back in with our featured interview featuring Dale DeGroff and Julie Reiner. Come on back.
Understand just what I mean. Now all through the week is quiet as a mouse, but on Saturday night.
All right, everybody, thanks for listening into the show. I do appreciate it as always, friends. Yeah, as you know, we are chatting with Dale DeGroff and Julie Reiner, and we're talking about women in the spirits industry in the cocktail world and talking a little bit about Marie Brizard and some other good stuff. Dale and Julie, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much.
Well, thank you very much.
Absolutely.
Thanks for having us.
Absolutely. It's my pleasure. And thanks for jumping through a few hoops and things like that to make the schedule work for everybody. And yeah, it's great to have you both here. Let me, because neither one of you have actually been a victim of the show yet so far. So for listeners out there who who are not familiar, most people probably know who you are. But let's get a little bit of your background. And I think you two know each other a little bit too. So maybe we can talk about that as well. And how about if I, Julie, if you're cool with this, since we'll start with maybe a touch of seniority and I start with Dale. How's that sound?
Go for it. Yeah.
Yeah, I did, in fact, spend some time chasing down this Julie Reiner person in New York City when I heard that she was working at a really cool hotel bar and making really fantastic drinks, and I finally managed, it was right off of Washington Square Park, which is a great little neighborhood in the village, and I found her behind the bar in the back of the restaurant, and true to the reports, the drinks were wonderful and she was delightful, and so I started sending all my friends there. And every time anyone called up and said, what's new and hot, I would say, well, you know, you better get down to, what was it called, C3, what was it called, Julie?
It was called C3. But I think he wants to know your background, Dale.
Well, that's fine. We can start wherever. But yeah, Dale, if you want to get us done. Either way, we'll weave it all together.
My background is just it's ancient history. So no, I worked at the Rainbow Room, obviously, for many years. And that was I had a serendipitous kind of career as a bartender. I just lucked from one great bar to another. And I was also a tree hugger. In other words, when I found a really good job, I'd just hang on for dear life. You know, these days, you know, bartenders travel around the world and do guests here and things. I mean, when I got a good job, I stayed until I got a better one or the place closed. You know, and I did. I ended up with great jobs. I worked at Charlie O's and Rockefeller Center, a Joe Bomb bar, which was fantastic, back in the 70s. And then I went out to L.A. and worked at one of the great hotels in the world, the Hotel Bel Air. Mm-hmm. Lucked into that job, and then I lucked into the Rainbow Room. I mean, it was just a fantastically lucky career. And the Rainbow Room was where I met Joe Bomb, my mentor, and mm-hmm. went back into the 19th century style of cocktail making.
Yeah, and were you kind of already into that, Dale, or were you kind of slinging rum and cokes to that point and started to discover a bigger world, or how did this kind of open up?
I was
up
trying
for you?
To be an actor. I came to New York City to be an actor. I was at the University of Rhode Island. I did a play at the Yale Drama Festival that was very kindly reviewed by a New York critic. I went back to the university, packed my bags, and headed for the big city.
Gotcha.
Expecting to be on Broadway in no time. And I was kind of near Broadway at the YMCA on 34th Street.
Got it.
Oh, well.
And so then you were supporting your acting habit through a real job bartending, right? Is that how that works?
Oh, well, there were lots of other jobs, putting up posters around town, sending Gideon Bibles out to hotels, working as a moving man. Oh, there was lots of stuff. You know, it was various. I loved the city, and I found out quickly that the bars were the natural resource, kind of like the redwoods in California. You know,
right.
That's where you needed to be.
Right, got it. And then so you moved on to publishing some books and stuff. We'll circle back at the end of the third segment here that we do, so people can find your publications. But how about let me bounce to you, Julie. So how did you get started, and then tell your side of the story of encountering Dale when he hunted you down.
I grew up in Honolulu, Hawaii. I started out in the industry, cocktail waitressing in Waikiki, serving pina coladas and strawberry daiquiris and Mai Tais to tourists. I bartended in college, and then I lived in San Francisco, and that was really kind of where I started learning, you know, real classic cocktails and kind of taking an interest in serving something, you know, better in a glass than most, you know. And then I moved to New York because my wife got into grad school at NYU, and, you know, she wasn't going to go if I didn't come with her. And I was not about to let her not go to NYU. So I started managing this little lounge that Dale speaks of. It was called C3 in the West Village. And, it was like a one-person bar, and I would cocktail waitress all of the tables and then go behind the bar and make all the drinks and deliver them. So I was kind of doing it all. And there was a theater next door that Dale, I guess, frequented or knew some people at, and they were like, "Oh, you got to check out what this girl's doing down in the bar." And I was kind of just trying to entertain myself and give people something really delicious in a glass. I was using fresh juices and making infusions and, you know, my own syrups, which at that time, you know, it was like the late 90s. That was groundbreaking, you know.
Mm-hmm. Novel,
imagine
right?
That. You juiced a lime. You're a genius. I sort of found myself on the front page of the food section of the New York Times, and Dale and Tony and Ted Hay and all these people came in. I realized that there were other people who cared about cocktails. And then, you know, cut to a couple of years later, I opened my first bar, which was Flatiron Lounge, in 2003 in 19th Street. And I followed that with partnering with Audrey Saunders on the Pegu Club. And then came out to Brooklyn and opened Clover Club, Lani Kai back in Manhattan, and then Leanda with Ivy Mix.
Right, and that's where that's what's going on right now, correct?
I'm in Brooklyn. Smith Street is my home, and you know, I'm really, Clover Club and Leanda are the two bars that I'm really involved with.
Gotcha. Okay, great. And let me ask you two this then. So when in the late 90s, when you're sort of talking about this, and I know you were kind of getting ramped up a little bit before that, Dale, if I'm not mistaken, and you mentioned Ted and you mentioned Tony and those folks, were you guys kind of a small little cabal there that were hanging out together and exploring this kind of stuff?
A small handful of people that really seemed to care about cocktails and using fresh ingredients. I mean, at that time, for me, like at least in New York City, everything was soda, everything was on the gun, you know, mm-hmm. and trying to get anything with fresh ingredients was almost impossible unless you went to the Rainbow Room and saw Dale.
right.
Or Sasha at Milk and Honey, but nobody knew where it was.
Right. Dale, did you want to add something to that? You're about to say something.
Except Dale.
Yeah, oh no, there was a what would you call it back in those days, at the beginning of the internet, a guy, actually the gentleman who's married to Audrey Saunders, had a blog, if you want to call that. He was a Microsoft executive, and his ad vocation was cocktails. And he really kind of garnered a worldwide collection of cocktail geeks who spent their time on this chat room, mm-hmm. you know, arguing about the most obscure, recipe questions that had no interest to anyone else but the seven of them. More than seven. But that's where Ted and some of these sort of geeky folks, you know, established themselves in the community. Ted's not even a bartender. Ted's a artist in the movie business.
Right.
But his avocation is also cocktails. And so this conversation went on for a good number of years, and I think it really was tremendously influential, certainly in gathering a kind of worldwide community that did end up finally all meeting one another in many cases, no matter where they all happened to be. And it also added, I think, a little bit to the nomadic kind of nature of the profession as it developed in the late 90s and in the early new millennium, which is not unusual, by the way, because Jerry Thomas, the father of the profession, spent a lot of time wandering around from one part of the country to the other and even over to London.
Right. So, I mean, I think it's one of those jobs, and it's still kind of the case to this day, where you have those skills, they will travel, right? Fair to say that.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. Well, so why don't we do this, y'all? Let's we got a couple minutes here before we take a break. So you guys are working with Marie Brizard, and we'll get into that story in a little bit. But you guys did a cocktail competition at Tales of the Cocktail, and that was pretty fun, huh?
It was great.
It was big fun. Yeah.
Yeah.
There were five finalists, but surprisingly, it was sponsored by Marie Brizard. Marie Brizard was, of course, one of the few women in the 18th century who actually ran a business and created a business and a formula for this wonderful anisette that carries her name to this day. There were many women who went to the competition. There were many men who went to the competition, and there were three men on the finalists and two women of the finalists, interestingly. Mm-hmm. So it was looking for the best bartender, and really gender didn't really come into it. I didn't even look at the names. Did you, Julie? I just looked at the recipes.
No. Well, Dale and I, we basically narrowed down the recipes to our, top, I think, 15 or so. We made all of them, and then we chose the top five without looking at the name or where the person was from or any of that.
I would know some of them, and Julie did too, and we didn't want to be swayed by that. So we just went to the list of ingredients and assessed it.
Well, let's do this, you guys. Let's take a little break here. We got to pause for a commercial break, and then we'll come back and talk a little bit more about the competition, and then I think you guys are going to tell us who the winner was. I only know who the five finalists are, so you'll break the news to me, probably not to anybody else, but I'm behind the curve. I live in New Orleans. It's cool. So, friends, we're going to take a little break here on the NOLA Drink Show. Come on back. All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Brian Deese here at WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans and in podcast land, wherever you may be. Thanks for listening into the NOLA Drink Show this week, friends. I do appreciate it as always. And we are chatting with two luminaries in the cocktail and spirits world, Julie Reiner and Dale DeGroff. And Dale, you're up in Rhode Island, and Julie, you're there. And are you in Brooklyn at the moment, Julie?
I am in the parlor at Clover Club right now, yeah.
Yeah, okay, got you. That's right. And you moved away from the door. I forgot we established that. And as Dale said, you moved to the bar. So.
Yes. You know, I didn't want you to have to listen to the delivery guys, asking me to sign for things. So.
Sure, fair enough, Julie. We'll buy whatever story you're telling us.
Right.
Well, yeah, so tell us a little. We were talking about the competition that y'all did at Tales of the Cocktail with Marie Brizard. And I think it was really cool as you were talking about how, you know, you kind of did it blind. You looked at the recipe, you didn't look at who the person was or where they were from. But there was an interesting, besides the brand itself, it was an interesting inspiration or set of guidelines for the competition. And Julie, you want to take that first? You want to tell us a little bit about how people were supposed to be inspired for their drinks?
Yeah, they basically, you know, they needed to tell us about what their style is, what they love about being a bartender. And they needed to also write about their inspiration for their drink. And so we had one person's inspiration was Lady Gaga, you know, and everything that she represents. There were many, many different inspirations, but the winning cocktail was inspired by her friend's grandmother, who was during World War II, was put in an internment camp. And she just had a really great story and really, it was a beautiful, beautiful inspirational story that she told. And then her cocktail was absolutely fantastic as well.
Great. So, go ahead, Dale.
The grandmother actually had a beautiful voice. And within the camp, which was called Manzanar, that was the name of one of the internment camps. Mm-hmm. She became known as the Songbird of Manzanar because of her beautiful voice. And it was an inspiration. It wasn't even the granddaughter. It was the granddaughter's friend. I forgot that, Julie. It was her friend. Inspired.
Okay.
She had all these really beautiful photos of her. And then the drink itself was great. She used the Marie Brizard Yuzu, which is one of my favorites in the line of liqueurs that Marie Brizard makes.
Mm-hmm. Do you want me to give the name? We're talking about Jenna Lane Ellenwood. Is that right?
Yep. Yes. Jenna Lane was the winner who worked at Dear Irving in New York City.
Okay, great. Yeah, and so she,
as it turned out,
go ahead,
owned by a friend, owned by a friend of ours, in fact, which is why we didn't look at the names in the first place, because we didn't want to know stuff like that. But the woman that she works for is one of the top bartenders in the city, and owns, it was partners in a couple of bars. Am I wrong, Julie?
I'm sorry. That
isn't she a partner in a couple of bars?
They've got like three or four different ones that she's a part of.
Okay.
Exactly.
Gotcha. Yeah. Go ahead, Dale.
What's her name again, Julie? Who owns it, or is partners with Dear Irving?
Megan Dorman.
Megan Dorman, this really points up how things have changed since I went to New York in 1969, that when I got the head bartender's job in 1987 at the Rainbow Room and hired 36 bartenders, among them about 8 women, my boss and my mentor, who was an old-fashioned restaurateur, you know, a genius in a lot of ways, but he made it known to me that those women should not be behind the front bar. And I bring that up because today, with women like Megan and Julie and Ivy and Audrey, some of the best, in fact, the best bars in the city are now run by women, with women behind them and men as well. But it really shows you how far we've come from the era.
Absolutely.
When
right.
It was required that the bartender back there wear a white jacket and be a man, you know.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I think we're seeing that, you know, speaking, you know, from a New Orleans perspective, of course, I think, you know, we see that here as well, And that's something you guys are going to stick around for our podcast only portion, which is called Another Shot with Noel Drinks. And we're going to get a little bit more into to that issue specifically. What we'll do too, y'all, is that the winning cocktail, the Songbird of Manzanar, we'll go ahead and we'll post that on our Facebook page for you when the show comes out. And we'll let you know what the recipe is, because then you can make it at home. Well, and let me ask you this, because you said this, Julie. Marie Bizarre was kind enough to send me three samples of their pretty good sized product line. I was surprised to see how much stuff they actually make, but you mentioned the Yuzu, and that is one of the ones I have sitting in front of me, and you mentioned it's one of your favorites.
Yeah, it's a really interesting liqueur, and one that I find works really beautifully in so many cocktails, particularly with gin, which is what the Songbird of Manzanar, the base is it's a gin cocktail. Mm-hmm. This has a really nice acidity to it. And it's just beautifully made.
It's kind of a traditional Japanese liqueur, isn't it? If I'm not mistaken.
Yeah. Yuzu is a sort of like a Japanese lime, I guess is how you would describe it. Is that right, Dale?
Yeah, it's probably the most tart of all the citrus in the citrus family, and it's got a extraordinarily pungent aroma and flavor. It's kind of like the cilantro of the citrus world, if you will.
Right.
That's good.
I like that. Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, it really didn't. When I was a journeyman bartender in the 70s and 80s and 90s, there really wasn't any yuzu around. I mean, it wasn't the mid 90s when Matsuhisa Nobu, you know, started using it. And we all became aware of it. You only saw it in Japanese restaurants. Mm-hmm. That and shiso were things that were just not in the cocktail world, you know. Mm-hmm. And now they are. Mm-hmm. Now they are, absolutely are. And as a matter of fact, there's a shiso leaf as a garnish in that drink. Jenna did. It's a beautiful drink. It's got a dash of plum vinegar, but don't be mistaken that it's a luscious plum vinegar. Japanese style, and a really good gin, an unusual vermouth from France called Quintina Blanc, which is unique flavor for vermouth.
Those are very. I really am a big fan of their line of vermouths. I think they're all very well made, very nice.
It was my cordial line at the Rain Brewer from 1987 to 1999 when we moved out.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
Extraordinarily well done cordial. The French, and they get it over there. They really understand how to do these things. I mean, not a lot longer than we have. And a lot of the stuff, a lot of the cordials we do here in the United States, sadly, are our sort of economy, in the economy category, if you will, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. to be kind.
Right. We're not going to name any names, but sure.
The French know how to use fruit.
Right, right. Well, would you say do you think that landscape is kind of changing? It seems that we're getting a little higher level of stuff that you can find these days, made here.
Absolutely.
In the States. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, for me, as you know, Dale and I talk about it because when I opened Flatiron Lounge, you know, it was Rizard was the only line that was really available to us that was at the quality level that we wanted, you know. Other than that, it was just very artificial tasting and just not the flavors that you wanted to put in your cocktails. Mm-hmm. You know, this is why I ended up trying to like make my own syrups and things like that to get the flavors that I wanted to be, to, you know, raspberries to taste like raspberries, mm-hmm. and, you know, and not like an artificial kind of thing. But Brizard really had the top of the line liqueurs, and I use so many of them with my first bar, and I still do. They're really great, but at this point there are quite a few that have come out, and yeah, the French definitely have a handle on how it's done.
Mm-hmm. And inspire us to do better over here. How about if we do this, you guys? Let's take a quick break, and then we're going to come back. We'll taste through another couple expressions of Marie Brizard and talk a little bit more with Jerry Dale. Can you guys hang on for a second?
Yeah.
Thanks. Friends, we'll take a little break here on the Noel Drinks Show. Come on.
Every afternoon when I wake up, say a little prayer and drink a.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Brian Diaz here with you. Thanks for listening in, friends, this week. As always, we are chatting with Julie Reiner and Dale DeGroth, who are kind enough to take some time out of their schedules there on the East Coast and chat with us down here in New Orleans and beyond. And we're talking about Marie Brizard here a little bit and liqueurs and some other things. And we talked about yuzu. I have the elderflower, y'all, and I have the apri. Where should I go next? Elderflower?
Well, elderflower is an interesting case in point, because in the early new millennium, I was working overseas in London as the cocktail director for the Match Bar Group, and really in this country we hadn't discovered elderflower yet as a flavor for cocktails. It really came in the new millennium, wouldn't you agree, Julie? I don't remember it ever in the 90s coming.
Yeah, no, I
London.
I actually, early at Flatiron Lounge, I bought an elderflower syrup that I found at like Calustian's or a high end store somewhere, and I created
hard
a cocktail that we had. It was very hard. Yeah, I had never. I bought it. I used to, Audrey and I used to call it shopping the shelves, and I would go and just look for weird stuff, things that I hadn't heard of, maybe, and I would buy them. And that was one of the things that I bought. And I put a drink on my menu called the Juniper Breeze that had this elderflower syrup in it. And then maybe like 2 years later, Rob, who created St. Germain, came in, and he had the elderflower liqueur. And
in London,
really,
they were using
became
elderflower cordial, more like a syrup, Julie.
Okay.
It wasn't
right.
Even a
Yeah, that's what I was using as well, the elderflower cordial. Yeah, and then once that came out, then it blew up and elderflower was everywhere.
It is, and it continues to be everywhere, doesn't it? But this is a very nice a very nice expression of them. I think one of the things too that I think with really the yuzu and the elderflower, and tell me what y'all think in your highly regarded professional opinions. The nice thing about the Marie Brizard stuff is they all have some nice sweetness. I'm not a big sweet guy, so I can see using these as a very nice modifier, and then not necessarily need to introduce, say, something like simple to a cocktail because it's bringing some sweet.
Absolutely.
Elderflower is just like a match with grapefruit. I think Julie and I both use it a lot when we're going in that direction. It's just made for grapefruit, like maraschino. Maraschino has a similar kind of affinity for grapefruit.
Right.
Yeah.
So there are certain ways we use these for...
Go ahead, Julie, please.
I was going to say that my, one of my tests for a liqueur, to see if I like it, is to try to create a stirred drink with the liqueur. Oftentimes, they poorly made liqueurs won't stand up in a stirred drink.
Mm. Why is that, Julie?
But because there's not much to hide behind.
Okay.
You don't have the citrus and the egg white and all these things that you're adding to it, that are going to affect the flavor of the drink. I think that it's harder to hide a poorly made product in a stirred cocktail.
Mm-hmm.
And both the yuzu and their elderflower and the apri I've used, for many years in various stirred cocktails. And they're all delicious and work beautifully. And the winner was a stirred drink with the yuzu.
Yeah, I guess. Okay, yeah, right. That makes sense. And that makes sense with that drink. Well, how about the apri? Because I also have that here. And that one, I had not tasted that one before from Marie Brizard. That's a very interesting liqueur.
That was one of the first ones that I worked with. I had read about some classic cocktails and that called for apricot liqueur, and I got that in, and Hotel National Special was like an old daiquiri variation that came out of Trinidad, and I loved it, and I used a ton of apri on my menus at Flatiron.
Okay, yeah, and you said, Dale, that was kind of one of the first ones from then that you started.
Yeah, I had it on a drink. I had a couple of drinks at the Rainbow Room way back in the day. There was a drink called Cocktail Algeria, which was made with pisco that use the apricot. Apricot's very fruit. I mean, Pisco's very fruit friendly. Brandy coming out of Peru, unaged brandy coming out of Peru, and that was one of the variations. Actually, that was on Julie. That was on Joe Baum's 1960 La Fonda del Sol menu. That cocktail Algeria with Pisco and apricot. It was.
That sounds delicious. By the way.
Wow.
Oh,
it sounds good.
Yeah. I think I have a bottle of Pisco downstairs.
I can drink one right now.
Right, exactly. You've inspired us here, Dale. Well, let me ask you this too about Mary Broussard, and we got about 4 minutes or so left, friends, before we got to close out the portion of the radio show here. You had mentioned that the bedrock of the brand is the anisette that they made actually a couple centuries ago, right? And then now it's a pretty expansive line, isn't it?
Oh my God! Yes.
Yeah.
I don't even know how many flavors they have.
I'm going to go with a lot.
They also made Geneva back then. You know, that was one of the second or third things. Curacao, anisette, and Geneva were their early products, I think, early on. And those were the things that were popular back then.
Okay.
Curacao in the early days of the cocktail world, Curacao, absinthe, and these were the additives, the modifiers that were used almost exclusively in the cocktail before vermouth arrived in this country, or when vermouth wasn't as popular in this country. Those were the modifiers. And I think Broussard and Bowles were a couple of the first companies to make these bitter orange liqueur, we know as Curacao.
Would you throw, it was Geneva kind of present during that time then too, at least in the United States, or is that more of a European?
The company made a Geneva. I saw the bottles and I was surprised to see that. I didn't realize they had made it. Geneva was the first gin. I mean, it was around before regular gin, before London gin. It was Hollands. They called it Hollands in all the old cocktail books.
I know a lot of the, you're right. I know a lot of the Geneva. Right. I know a lot of the Geneva people that I've talked to, when you tell them that it's sort of like gin or an antecedent of gin, they get upset. So we got to make sure that it gets its own category or we'll make people mad, right?
it's back again.
Yeah, it is back again. It was all over the place last year at Tales of the Cocktail, that's for sure, and actually this year too. Well, how about if we do this, y'all? We got about 2 minutes left before I have to close out the portion of the radio show, and you guys are going to stick around for another shot with Nola Drinks. We're going to talk a little bit more about women and spirits in the industry, both historically and contemporarily. But Julie, will you tell people where they can connect with you, either online or come see you at one of your fine establishments?
Sure, yeah. Well, if you're in New York, I am on Smith Street, 210 Smith Street and 221 Smith Street at Clover Club and Leanda. Online, I'm at Mixtress NYC on Instagram. And that's where you can find me.
All right, perfect. That's great. And and you're generally here during Tales of the Cocktail. You come down to this part of the world, don't you, every year?
I do, yeah. I took a year off, but I came back this year and had a great time and thought it was beautifully executed.
Yeah, things are going in the right direction there. That's something we talk a lot about here on the show. But Dale, what about yourself, Dale?
KingCocktail.com is good. My presence online. I've just turned in the manuscript and finished the photography for Tales of the Cocktail 2020, which is the 2002 book that I wrote, first book I wrote. And this is a new edition, and that'll be out in September of 2020. Craft and Essential are the two cocktail books that are on the market now that I wrote. And, over the years I did a column for Drinks Magazine in London, and I did a column called 411 here in New York City, which was interviews with bartenders. I think I did you, Julie. I think I interviewed you for 411.
Right.
Yes,
you
did.
Well, cool. Well, so
411.
There you go. Well, KingCocktail.com is kind of the hub for you, Dale, for listeners out there that want to connect with what you do.
That's a good, KingCocktail.com is exactly where they should go.
Okay, perfect.
Learn all about that.
Great. You guys, you got to stick around for another shot with Nola Drinks. But friends, if you're listening here on the radio, going to sign this portion off. Go to NolaDrinks.com or your favorite podcast platform. Get it there. This conversation is going to continue in just a second. But if you are listening on the radio, friends, remember to be kind to one another. Use your turn signal. And until next time, cheers, y'all.
All right, everybody, up. It's another Shot with Noel Drinks. I appreciate you sticking around. Brian Diaz here with you as always. Hope you are digging the conversation we're having with Dale and Julie. We're about to bounce right back into that in just a second. I'm going to get into a little bit more about some of the historical context and maybe some specifics about how the landscape has changed a bit with women in the cocktail bartending spirits industries. And then after that, I'll be back with my parting shot. Here we go. Yep, another Shot with Noel Drinks. Brian Diaz here with you, friends. Thanks for listening in this week. As always, we're chatting with Dale DeGroff and Julie Reiner, and we're talking about Marie Brizard a little bit, some of the spirits they have, the cocktail competition that they sponsored during Tales of the Cocktail just this past July. We tasted through a few expressions, and you know, part of the idea or part of the impetus for the cocktail competition was the contestants were asked to make a drink based on a female that inspired them, either maybe directly in their lives or historically or something like that. And we were talking, you know, a little bit, part of the theme here that we want to cover is talking about women in the spirits world, women in the industry. Marie Brizard, I think, is an interesting story, maybe even as a starting point, for lack of a better way to put it. And then moving forward to the landscape today, do you guys want to kind of jump in there? I mean, and take a sort of historical journey. Dale, do you want to start with that? Yeah, go ahead.
There's for the first time in there are numbers of female master distillers, which just was not the case, you know, 50 years ago or 30 years ago. And now there are multiple brands that have women at the helm and when it comes to the distilling world, and that's a huge change.
Mm-hmm.
That's a sea change. And I described earlier about women in Midtown Manhattan or in any fancy hotel bar around the country, for that matter. You wouldn't see a woman behind that bar. And there was a woman behind a fancy bar, the Savoy Hotel, way back at the turn of the 19th to the 20th century. And, you know, I think it was American businessmen who were going over there doing business internationally, finally, who complained to the hotel managers that they thought it was inappropriate for this woman to be behind the bar, and don't you know, they fired her.
Wow. I had not heard that story.
That's something. Yeah. It was Harry Craddock who took over for her, an American bartender, in exile, by the way, but from Prohibition.
Mm-hmm.
She had been working there for years when he came along, and she was kind of replaced by Harry. And it had to do with certain guests, most of them Americans, making complaints to the management that they thought it was inappropriate for a woman to be in the bar room.
This is something, I mean, that's really interesting to hear, and I never heard that part of the story before from the bar. Is it something where, how shall I phrase this question? When we look at, say, like Marie Brizard and that story of the brand that, you know, dates back to the 18th century, is this a little bit of a whitewashing of history? Are we starting to dig deeper and discover that there was a far greater involvement of women in the spirits world, in the cocktail world? It just kind of was ignored historically?
Oh, I would believe so. Don't you think, Jill? Well, Madame Clicquot, I mean, she was the boss of Buff Clicquot.
Right.
You know, there must be. Yeah. I know that in the world of literature, you know, women had to use men's names to write. So yeah, they had a terrific presence. It turns out that some of the great composers' wives were also pretty amazing musicians.
Great composers,
you know,
exactly.
About that either.
Right, right. What do you think, Julie?
What they did.
Oh, go ahead, Dale. Or Julie.
No.
Yeah. I was going to say also, you know, it's like you look at during like World War II, you know, World War I, like women took over for the jobs that a lot of these men, you know, had left to go and fight the wars. And, you know, they were building planes. They were also making cocktails, you know. They were doing all of those things. And then the men came back and said, oh, I'll take my job back and you can go and raise babies again, you know.
Again.
Yeah. Here with my mom, women, who's 93, and she was making machine gun belts.
Oh,
right here in Westerly, Rhode Island, at a textile factory.
Well, yep. Julie, you know, in your case, then, what year did you come into the business, or when did you start bartending?
I started bartending when I was in college.
And this was in Hawaii, correct?
I graduated from high school in Hawaii, and I was cocktail waitressing in bars while I was there.
Okay,
but. The first time, but all of the bartending jobs in Hawaii it was all union. It was all men behind the bar. I would look back there and ask them questions, but there was, you know, no way I was ever getting behind the bar at any of these places. And then when I went to college, I got a job at a place called The Pub in Tallahassee, Florida, where I went to Florida State University.
Okay.
And that was my first bartending job. So, yeah, I was, you know, 22, the first time I was behind the bar.
Now, and was...
It must have been interesting in that era down there, huh?
Yeah. Is it kind of a college bar kind of scene?
With all the yahoos?
Oh, yeah. This was like beer and a shot. You know, they used to do what they called bladder bust, where it was like free beer until somebody used the bathroom. So all of the football players. Oh, yeah. You can imagine the things that we found at the end of the night. You know, yeah. that was not a pitcher of beer.
right. I should not share this too much out of my past, but there was a 25-cent beer night concept in the early 90s when I was finishing up undergraduate, and we flogged that horse pretty well. So,
oh, yeah.
But go on.
You know, back in the 90s.
It was that kind of a place, and you know, but and so I wasn't making any, you know, anything, any crazy drinks, but it was, yeah, you know, I would make martinis and Manhattans and whiskey and Coke and, you know, all these sort of, you know, highball drinks. But it wasn't a serious cocktail bar by any means, but I certainly realized that I loved being behind the bar.
Okay.
And then I didn't want to leave that position from that.
So was it the drinks, Julie? Was it the hospitality, kind of all of the above, and that piqued your curiosity?
Yeah. I mean, really a combination. I think what I loved about being behind the bar was that, you know, there was a level of respect that you got from being back there, and you were controlling the flow of alcohol in the room, and therefore, you know, there was the level of respect you got from being on the other side of that piece of wood, you know, as opposed to being on the floor with a tray in your hand, was like night and day.
Mm-hmm.
And I had done both, you know, and so yeah, I was like, this is where I want to be.
Gotcha. And so then you kind of took the journey to learn the craft of bartending.
I moved out to San Francisco and I started really learning how to make real cocktails and studying a little bit more. And it really wasn't until I got to New York City that I really took it as seriously as I did and started, you know, tinkering around with infusions and syrups and that sort of thing. And then I met Dale and I was like, oh, okay. I would go to events with Dale and I would just stand and watch him cut a pineapple and be like, oh, that's a much better way to cut a pineapple.
Right.
I just like stand close to Dale because I never really worked directly with Dale, even though, you know, you read so many articles, they're like, they call me his protege, or they'll say that I would, you know, he was my mentor. And I'm like, he was a mentor, but we actually never worked together. I just would kind of,
I think they're confusing Audrey with you when they say that.
Yeah, they are.
Audrey
exactly.
did, in fact, work with me.
Yeah, but I would sort of troll Dale while he was prepping and at these events so I could learn some things.
Gotcha. That's a good, Dale, you're a good person to learn from. So good move there, Julie. Way to glean.
Yep.
So with currently then, I guess we'll kind of fast forward here pretty quickly. You've touched on this. We have touched on this a little bit, how the landscape has changed, where we see more women in master distilling roles. I think we see more women behind the stick in general. We certainly see more women in like a brand ambassador positions and things like that. So okay. The landscape has certainly changed. But, you know, I can, you know, again, speak from the New Orleans perspective. I come from California. I can speak to that perspective a little bit. Sometimes I'm reminded that we're in certain places, we're in a little bit of a bubble, and it maybe seems better than it is. What are some of
absolutely.
Your...
Absolutely.
Yeah, please elaborate on that.
I mean, I have seen it, you know, I mean, the numbers of women in all facets of the spirits industry have certainly increased. You know, but there are still a lot of attitudes and people, particularly outside of this country, that still hold the views that women don't belong behind bars. I recently, or a couple of years ago, Charles Schulman, who has received the, you know, he won Best International Bar this year, and the year before he was given a Lifetime Achievement Award. He came into my bar. He was doing this film, and basically interviewed me and talked to me and told me that he didn't believe that women don't belong behind the bar past 3 p.m.
Oh my goodness.
Because they should be going home to cook dinner for whoever they are cooking dinner for, you know, and I looked at him and it's funny because they've been showing this film on Delta recently, and I've been getting all of these screenshots and people reaching out to me, and they edited out a lot of what I said to him, you know, but I was like, you're standing in a bar that's owned by three women, and you're telling me that I don't belong behind my bar past 3 p.m., you know?
Wow.
And this is somebody who, and we're still holding him up and revering him and giving, you know, which makes me scratch my head, you know, that it's, you know, and the attitude, oh, he's just old school. I'm like, if you were to switch women to people of color in that sentence,
right.
It would be an outrage.
Absolutely.
You know?
Absolutely. And go on, please.
So, yeah, I mean, that's something that you know, it was really eye-opening to me because I felt like we were really making so much headway, and we are. But I think outside of this country and outside of cities that are very forward-thinking and, you know, that we have a lot of work to do still.
Mm-hmm. Now, I hope that you said he's telling you that you don't belong in your bar after 3 p.m. Did you say you don't belong in my bar at all, ever?
No, it's just women in general. Yeah, it's just like they can work the lunch shift was basically what he was telling
unbelievable.
Me.
Unbelievable. Okay.
Wow. Yeah, I still find it unbelievable. But yeah, I mean, if you watch the movie, you can see the look on my face when I'm talking to him. Like, really?
Wow.
Yeah.
Now, Dale, since you've been in the industry for a while, what is, you know, your perspective on this? You know, I think when you started, it was definitely more male dominated. What are some of your thoughts?
Well, I mean, I travel around the country and around the world, I work a lot overseas now. I did 5 cities in Australia this last year, and I made it known to every group of bartenders I spoke to that if you come to New York, you're going to find out that women are running the best bars in the city.
Mm-hmm.
You know, mm-hmm. There's still a little male dominated down there in Australia, but there are some women behind the bar that are doing amazing things. The attitude changes really from owner to owner. You know, it's hard to put a generalization on it. I mean, obviously, sure. If you're going to be in the Middle East or someplace like that, it's going to be all male dominated. But, you know, in most of the sort of Western world, London, France, Amsterdam, even though, you know, there's still some of that left, there's a lot more opportunity for women than there ever was before now. And I see it as a judge also in world class that there's so many more women competing. And you saw that, Julie. So many more women competing than there ever were when I started as a judge in the very first year in London many years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very healthy and I've never seen such a community before in this profession. When I was a young bartender in the 70s, there was no community. This was every man for himself, you know. They used to pit bartender against bartender by counting their registers at the end of the shifts. And if your register was $1,000 below the bartender down the bar, then they wanted to know why. And, you know, and if it happened too many times, they were going to find somebody else to run that register. You know, it was a much different world. The community of bartenders today is most extraordinary. I mean, what our friends Ivy Mix and Lynette Marrera are doing with something called Speed Rack, raising hundreds of thousands of dollars for hospitality workers in the breast cancer, suffering from breast cancer. And Tony Abogonin with his charity also doing exactly the same thing. And just the crowd rise things that happen, because bartenders don't have any health insurance. You know, a wonderful bartender from Seattle, Washington, I don't want to get into names and stuff, but he was suffering from, he needed a heart transplant. And he had no health insurance. And within 7 days, Brian.
Wow.
$250,000 worldwide in a crowdrise.
Crowdsource funding, yeah.
Website.
Wow.
Unbelievable. I mean, that kind of stuff just didn't happen in the 70s. Well, first of all, there's no internet. But, you know, there was no such thing as that kind of community in this profession.
I think that's a really neat part
about
it. Yeah, and I think that's a really nice thing that we see in the industry here these days, across all kinds of things. You know, supporting issues in health and wellness in the workspace, safer workspaces, all these other, you know, considerations that you've just touched on, Dale, as well. Let me ask you one last question. I'll direct this to you, Julie, and then I know we got to bounce. I know it's kind of a big question, so I'll kind of try and narrow it down a little bit. As somebody who operates a bar, Why does inclusivity matter? Maybe even putting the ethical side away, but from a business perspective, why does that matter to you?
Well, I mean, it's proven that businesses that are more inclusive and both gender and race are more successful. You know, mm-hmm. For me, it's always been about having the most, you know, diverse, wide range of people working within my establishment and giving opportunities to everyone. You know, mm-hmm. if you look around my bars, you see, you know, it's men, women, gay, straight, you know, you name it.
On both sides of the bar, you're saying.
Yeah. Oh, mm-hmm. yeah, absolutely. On both sides of the bar and on the floor as well. You know, we try to keep an open mind to anyone who wants an opportunity. You're not going to come into a bar that I'm a part of and see only white men behind the bar.
right. Got it. Well, thank you. Well, do me a favor really quickly, Dale, tell us one more time where people can connect with you, the website.
KingCocktail.com.
Perfect. Great. And go ahead.
Oh. No, just one word, KingCocktail.
Yeah, KingCocktail.com. And cool, we'll find you gallivanting around the cocktail world as well. And you, Julie, please?
Yeah, CloverClubNY.com, LeandaNY.com, and at MixtressNYC on Instagram.
Excellent. Thanks you two so much for taking some time out today. I really appreciate it.
Anytime.
Oh, it was great fun, Brian.
Thanks. Yeah, we'll have to get together soon.
See you soon, Julie.
See you soon, Dale.
Thanks, y'all. Hey, friends. Brief musical interlude, and I'll be back with my parting shot. All right, everybody. Thanks for listening into the show this week, friends. I do appreciate it. Yeah, great show. It was a pleasure to chat with Dale and Julie. That was a long in the works. Tried to organize the taping of this particular show during Tales of the Cocktail in July, and we couldn't get everybody's schedules to line up. So we are finally able to pull it off through the wonderful world of modern technology by telephone. There you go. Hey, this is our parting shot, friends. Kind of building a little bit on what we talked about during the show today. I was doing some digging around. I was very curious about certain statistics and representation of women working as bartenders. And I came across something that I was kind of surprised by, I guess. The Bureau of Labor Statistics in 2018 reported that fully 57.2% of bartenders are women. But I think we still see in the craft cocktail scene, and that's kind of the angle from which I'm coming here, it's still very male-dominated. And I will say this, that I think we touched on this in the interview a bit. Here in New Orleans, and I should probably even be more specific, the places that I tend to go in New Orleans, it's kind of a bubble.
because we do see, I think, a better representation of women in leadership roles in the service industry, behind the bar, executive chefs, so on and so forth. But I think when we start to spread this out across, I'm speaking to the U.S. in particular, the rest of the country, that landscape changes quite a bit. And you also certainly don't have to go particularly far to certain neighborhoods in other parts of the greater New Orleans area to see things change quite a bit as well. So the craft cocktail scene, again, continues to be, I think it's changed a lot, as Julian Dale noted, but it's still largely male-dominated. I think a lot of people still have that stereotype, although I think it is going away, fortunately, in many places, of the, you know, white dude with a mustache and tats and wearing suspenders. But that's still out there, and that's kind of an unfair stereotype as well, but it still, I think, kind of informs a lot of people's views of what a craft cocktail bartender is. And, you know, one of the things that I think is that, you know, let's kind of take this as an assumption for the conversation. When you go into a spot that is a craft cocktail bar, it is a professional bar, they have a professional program, and they're good at what they do, everybody that's going to be working behind the bar, for the most part, is a good bartender, regardless of their gender, their ethnic origin, their sexual identity, whatever we're talking about here. That's why they're behind the bar. So let's just kind of make that as a starting point here, and really kind of as we go into these places and patronize these places, let's just take, you know, come on, that's how this works. Now, I hear a lot of funny things behind the bar, and it's a conversation that we've had on the show before, and I think to women out there that work in the industry, or women in general, you know exactly what I'm talking about, and I think a few of the guys out there probably get this too, and have heard it. My wife is a decorative artist, and she has a decorative arts firm that she's run for 25 years in the New Orleans area, very well-respected professional. And the types of things that she will come home and tell me at the end of a day that she's heard occasionally on project sites where she and our team are working around subcontractors and other trades in the construction business, it's kind of ridiculous. And I could go on and on and on forever about some of the ones. My very favorite one is somebody said to her, somebody who has almost certainly worked in their respective industry a lot shorter amount of time than my wife Sylvia has, as I said, for 25 years. And they said, and I quote, "You know, this is an active construction site, right?" Okay, yeah. I've been working around trades for 25 years on construction sites when doing decorative arts projects. Thank you very much. And I think we see this and we hear this, friends, when we're at the bars. It's kind of common when there will be when there's a woman behind the bar, there's the diminishing of knowledge question or diminishing of skill question. Oh, do you know how to make an old fashioned? As opposed to saying, as you might say to a male bartender, "I'd like an old fashioned, please." There's that one. There's the challenging of knowledge. Oh, so you know something about whiskey. Think about how that's phrased when you say that. These people are professionals doing a professional job, and they've been hired because they are professionals and have this skill, knowledge, talent, et cetera, et cetera. I was recently at Tales of the Cocktail at the Independent Spirits Tasting Room, and there was a woman who was a head distiller from a small craft distillery out of Colorado, if I remember correctly, whiskey stuff primarily they made. And she was representing their company behind the table, pouring for people. Right in front of her was a table stand that had her picture. It was like a 11 by 14 kind of thing. And it said her name and it said head distiller. And as we were walking away from the table, some bro comes up to the table and says, "Oh, so you're in charge of the whole thing," meaning the production process. "Yeah, chief, the sign says head distiller right there. That's her job. That's what she does." Another one that I hear a lot too, and I hear this directed towards bartenders in general, both male and female, really anyone, but I think it kind of skews a little bit more towards women. I've certainly heard it come out that way towards women more. The kind of type of question of, what do you want to be when you grow up? As if it's not a trade or a profession that maybe that is what you want to do for the rest of your life, right? There's that one. Another one that I think you hear out there from time to time, and I was reading some stuff, different articles and snippets, citing women who are bar owners, restaurant owners, and talking about when they have a team, and there was one in particular that was talking about having a team in place where they had a few more women behind the bar than they do men. She hired the most talented people that she thought needed to be hired to properly execute her program, no more than no less. And patrons would come in and say, "Oh, more women than men behind the bar. Do you have an agenda? What are you trying to say?" "Oh, well, that's something you don't see every day." And her response was, "See what? A talented team that's able to execute my program?" So many quotes and so many things that we hear about that in these circumstances still continue to this day. And in these spaces where we are talking about a craft cocktail bar, where we are talking about bartenders who are true professionals and are hired as such for the trade because of their skills and their ability. Again, no more, no less. Now, we pointed out that we see that there are more women as master distillers. I think we see more women in roles of brand ambassadors, for example, you know, more in the profession in general. But we still continue to have so much tone-deaf conversation that takes place in these spaces in this male-dominated situation of diminishing women, not acknowledging their skill, assuming they are incompetent or don't know their job, or assuming that they're there to be eye candy and not be professionals to provide you professional-level hospitality and a professional-level cocktail. This is something that we always want to talk about here on the show, is the importance of inclusivity. We touched on it with Julie. It's something we've talked about in the past, and we will continue to talk about it in the future. I mentioned that 57.2%, this is for the record here, 57.2% of all bartenders are women. 84.3%, this is in 2018, again, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, 84.3% of bartenders are white, not broken down by gender, just period. 7.3% are African American, 2.9% are Asian, and 15.1% are Hispanic or Latino. Long way to go on that front. Now, again, 57.2% are bartenders. Good number. But let's compare that to chefs and head cooks. Only 22% of chefs and head cooks are women. 61% of those are white. Total number of chefs. 61% are white. 17.2% are African American. 16.6% Asian. And 26.6% Hispanic and Latino chefs or head cooks. So, you know, we've got a long way to go. And we've got a long way to go in spaces where maybe the numbers look pretty good, but the attitudes still prevail in ways that are inappropriate. So friends, when you're out, remember to treat your bartenders, staff people, front of house, back of house, anyone in hospitality. They're there for a reason. They've been hired because they're good at what they do. Treat them with the respect that is due that consideration. Friends, that's our parting shot. Here's to you.